Hi, this is Alan Chartok, delighted to be live at the Albany Law School today in conversation with Stephen Gottlieb. In addition to being a commentator on WAMC, Stephen Gottlieb is the J. and Ruth Kaplan Distinguished Professor of Law at Albany Law School. He served on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union and in the U.S. Peace Corps in Iran. Steve Gottlieb's latest book is Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Court, and the Breakdown of American Democracy. He has written or edited several books in the fields of constitutional law and jurisprudence, and is also widely known for his work on the Supreme Court, constitutional theory, and election campaign law. His articles have appeared in New York University Law Review, Yale Law and Policy Review, Hastings Law Journal, and Boston University Law Review, among many others. Welcome, Stephen Gottlieb.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, I've been trying to think of a question that might stump you for the first question. Okay. So here it is. Do you see any similarities between the Ayatollah Khomeini and the Roberts Court?
Yes.
Please explain.
They're definitely trying to lead both countries in very much the wrong direction. Mm. And another similarity, they're both trying to lead their countries away from democratic government. You may have noticed in your own news reports that they've blocked, is it the grandson of the former commanding Ayatollah, from even running for office? God forbid, he would be too liberal. It would be too democratic. This court has taken part in efforts to block lots of people from voting. It has shifted power in this country, not only through campaign finance decisions, but through its handling of all the commercial cases that come to the court. It shifted money and power away from average Americans and toward those who have more than they can figure out what to do with. And of course, we all know that it's also established the Second Amendment as meaning that you have a right to concealed, a right to carry your gun in your home and around for self-defense. And it has also set itself against the efforts of the American people to continue the melting pot. And all of those things, as I'm sure our interlocutor today knows well, are very much against the teachings of his profession, against what the political scientists have been telling us for almost as long as we're the same age, both been alive. I started reading about the political science of this issue when I was in high school, and significant strides started to be made in the aftermath of World War II and the breakdown of democracy at that point in many countries of Europe, and that study has continued. And in each one, democracies fail when the disparities of wealth and power become too great. There are all sorts of reasons for that, and we can talk about it, but that's one of the clearest findings that we get from the research in political scientists. They fail when due process protections are lost. And we can talk about some of the cases that I find absolutely outrageous, but that make life much less secure for many Americans, with all sorts of consequences, political consequences, consequences on, in fact, who can vote. And the decisions that they've made on guns makes it much easier for the paramilitary organizations, which exist all around the United States, although they've been most well known in some of the Western states as they are on that federal, is it a forest or a park? But anyway, federal land in the West where there's this occupation by a sort of a militia group out there. But when those team up with wealth and power, that's when we start finding death squads and things of that sort. And we know that the militia groups in the United States have been linked to people like Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, and a lot of men, women, and children in the process. Not that any one of those categories is less sacred than the other, frankly. They're all sacred categories, and we mourn the loss of all of them. But also, people affiliated with those groups have been involved in other hate crimes around the country. So that's been a problem. And then, of course, As I mentioned, the cases where they have set themselves against the efforts to continue the melting pot in the United States. All of these ways are ways in which the political science profession has been telling us for years that democracy becomes more at risk, that the people with wealth and power, as that split becomes greater, they start to circle the wagons. Now, that's perhaps a generational phrase that we, Alan and I, remember it from the old Western movies. The wagon trains would do a circle when they thought the Indians were around. But people of wealth and power start circling their wagons to protect themselves against those who have very little. And as that develops and the polarization between the sides increases, people become much less committed to democracy. Nothing could be worse than their winning an election. And democracy doesn't just fall apart, it often gets blown apart in that situation. So these are a group of trends that are very frightening to me, which is why the Roberts Court is definitely like the Ayatollah.
I have so many questions to ask you. I guess my point about the Ayatollah and the Roberts Court is that these are two institutions which really represent the power elite, right? And make sure that they stay where they are. And, you know, I wanted to ask a question about John Roberts. If he read your book, would he like it?
No, I hope not. I have turned down opportunities to write a brief in the Supreme Court.
Right.
Because
you don't want to see the guy.
No. I've taken my class down there. But no, because I've written about the court before, including about half of the justices. And I don't necessarily think that representing a client and writing rather critically about some of the justices go together very well. So I rather somebody else's name is on the briefs.
So if we put the thing I would like to ask people about, a lie detector on his arm, and you say, has Gottlieb been mean to you and unfair? The answer he might say is yes, right?
Well, I would expect he might say that, yeah. But it wouldn't have any reference to the truth.
Aha. And so then the question would be, would he believe in his own mind that he was telling the truth? So in other words, let's just say you get a flat line for telling the truth and you get a wiggly line for lying. And you say, okay, Justice Roberts, Chief, are you telling us that Gottlieb has been unfair to you and mean to you? And he says, yes, I am. Do you get a wavy line or a straight line?
Well, I suppose to your question, it doesn't matter whether I think very much of lie detectors as an instrument.
Then forget about that.
And I think Roberts is a pretty cool cookie, so I suspect he could control his lines. But Alan, what I tried to do in the book was to come up with something that we all say we believe in, which is self-government, democracy. This is a democratic country. That's what we stand for ourselves, in our communities, and in the world. And so I tried to go back to a standard that is not a capital D democratic standard or a capital R Republican standard, but one that is an American standard that we all claim to share. And then looked at how that notion of self-government was being understood around the world and in this country, and the notions that our ancestors in this country had about how they were going to preserve and protect self-government. And then I followed that into the courts of foreign countries looking at the question, and then finally into the political science, which is a substantial piece of the book. And it's only with that basis that I got to the Roberts Court cases. Now, could an uninformed person or a person who scoffs at the political science, like so many of them scoff at the environmental findings, could such a person come up with theories that suggest, oh, what they're doing is great for democracy? People can convince themselves of anything. But the fact is that the evidence is very strong, very consistent, developed by scholars using a whole raft of different techniques, as the numbers grew, we went from techniques that involved case studies of specific countries that went very deeply into the developments in those countries to statistical studies that looked at every country in the world. Eventually, Al Gore was charged with putting together something that he called the State Failure Task Force. It morphed into something with a slightly different name, the Political Instability Task Force. But basically, he got together a group of scholars at many different institutions, and they put together a database which included every year that a country is democratic, and then traced by year whether that democracy fell. So that developed another way of looking at the data and the route to instability. And then there's a group that developed game theoretical studies of why democracies fail. And all of these things fit in the explanation of why things happen and the data that shows that they have been happening in the way that political scientists have been predicting. So on that basis, fair-minded person whose objective isn't, oh, we must believe X, I think should come to the conclusion that this court is not the whole problem, certainly, but a significant part of what's been going wrong in this country. I think a lot of people don't realize how much the courts matter in our commercial relations. But of course, we in law school, that's a large part of what we study. We come into law school and we study it both in the contract situation, and most of that is business contracts. And we study it in the tort situation because then it becomes a question of, well, is business responsible even when it hasn't signed a contract? Because there are values that we stand for. You can't run people over, and you can't defraud them, etc. You can't put poison into them. And in all of those ways, the court affects our commercial relationships. And when it, for example, decides that everything is going to be done by contract and by arbitration, and we can talk about how that came about, and in those arbitrations, it's okay that the maker of the contract has specified who the arbitrator is going to be, so that they stand very little chance of losing. And they limit the amount that can be awarded even when the consumer has suffered great damage. That's a significant transfer of economic power. And then you put that together with the court's handling of the antitrust laws, which have made it very difficult to prosecute companies for antitrust violations. And so, you know, the economist will say, well, okay, you can make a deal with somebody else. There are 1,000 things wrong with that statement. But the fact is that somebody else is just as insulated as the first company, and they end up all doing the same thing. So the court has really put a straitjacket on ordinary Americans and passed all or as much of their goodies to the corporations as they can manage to do.
Don't we have John Roberts to thank for Obamacare? Isn't that an example of, you know, democracy, people wanting it, and he did what they wanted? This is a trick question because I wanted to see whether you're willing to acknowledge that he may have done something positive.
Well, then you've just given me the answer.
Yeah.
But yes, sure, he did make that decision. Now, what Obamacare is actually doing, I mean, most people, it's been said, but I don't know how many people remember or realize, Obamacare is a Republican plan. And it was a plan designed to give as much as possible to corporate America. So, yeah, Roberts undoubtedly realized he was very unpopular with many of the conservatives for what he did, but in terms of the economic instincts, it really isn't on the opposite side of this.
Well, let's assume he had said no and voted with his usual colleagues, and the program got, you know, basically out the window. The question then would be, why wouldn't they applaud, the conservatives and the Republicans applaud him for doing what he's always been doing?
Well, they would.
Yeah, so
I misunderstand your question.
Well, my question is, he decided he was going to support the program.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you say he did it because the economic interest, the insurance companies, I agree with that. The insurance companies were beneficiaries of the whole thing. But what if he had said no?
Can I back up a second? I want to answer that. But when you said he did it because, I make no pretense of being able to get under his skin and into his brain. So what his private reasoning was, I have met a couple of the members of the court, but I have never met him, and even those that I've met, I don't really know very well. So I don't make that claim. Now, the other question is, if he had gone the other way, would he have been celebrated? Certainly he would. And that might well have been an example of the right wing shooting itself in the foot and not realizing how good this was for them. I think a lot of their opposition has been driven by the fact that there are racists on the right who are very upset by the idea that a black man can develop policy in the United States. But actually, this was designed as a very Republican plan. And I don't have any doubt that Obama understood that and figured that was the only way he was going to get health coverage for the majority of Americans. But nevertheless, we've noticed right here locally that there's been a lot of combination of the medical establishments, so there are many fewer choices than there used to be. And it's pretty obvious on the level of hospitals, but it's also obvious on the level of doctors, because they're all affiliated now in just a few practices. So it has turned out, whatever benefits that it has, and I don't want to try to say that it doesn't have some benefits, but it has turned out to be one that is very good for corporate America. And Obama understood he wasn't going to get a health plan unless he did that.
I think we're going to have a congressional race around here between Zephyr Teachout and probably John Faso, who, you know, I know feels that Obamacare, Faso, is the worst thing that has happened in this country, and that Obama is personally very unpopular, and that he's going to win his election based on those two factoids. So that while it may be a Republican plan, I would suggest to you that really it's not such a Republican plan that every single Republican in the country is lined up against it and have tried numerous times to kill it.
That's clearly true. And they've been talking it up as a terrible thing. But, you know, it did start with Romney in Massachusetts.
It did.
And it has lots of elements of choice in it so that people aren't simply told what they have to do, but they're given options about how to do it. It's based in the insurance companies. It's really a plan about funding. It's not really a plan about who gives us our care. I mean, that kind of plan would include funding for training and supporting pediatric practices and general practice practices and family practices. That kind of thing isn't built into the plan. And I have to say, the person that introduced us, Alicia Ouellette, Dean Ouellette,
President Ouellette,
President Ouellette, all of those things, both my former student and my boss, is much more knowledgeable about how we could have created a better medical plan than I am, because law and medicine has been a specialty of hers, and she has some wonderful books in that field. But I think it's quite clear that a Democratic plan would have been quite different from what got passed, and that Obama was able to get a portion of the Republicans to support him in the beginning because there were Democrats for whom it was too right-wing.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Gottlieb, let me ask you this. We're about to have a presidential election. Obviously, to me and to others, you don't have to go any further than to say who gets appointed to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
But I don't think the American people have ever understood that relationship because I don't think they understand what the court is and what it's done.
I remember an ad in the, I think it was the 1984 campaign, and I think it was People for the American Way that did an ad that said, when you vote, think about whom they will appoint. And it had some pictures of justices. So this argument has been going on a long time, and I don't think the American people realize just how important it is. And when Roberts talks about standing there and just calling balls and strikes, as many of you will remember that he did in the confirmation hearings in the Senate, some of us grew up yelling at the top of our lungs, kill the umpire, because their balls and strikes and other calls don't seem to have been accurate. And now that, you know, we can tell what's a ball or a strike or which horse won or whatever, in so many different areas, we're finding just how inaccurate the umps and referees really are. And the reality is, law is about judgment. The idea that there are, lots of people come to law school expecting to find clear lines, and this is the rule. And there are some things that are a rule, right? President has to be 35 years old, and I was going to say it has to be a native-born American. Now we know how clear that rule isn't, right? Because it turns out a native-born American has been defined by Congress, and in a reasonable way that I think is okay, but it turns out that's a little less clear. And there are parts of the world when the date of your birth is considered somewhat differently than from the day that you emerge from your mother's body. In Japan, I think it's the date of conception. So that 35 could be, but law is like that. Law is usually the conjunction of lots of considerations operating together on the same thing. And that means that the clarity of law is ordinarily a mirage. And particularly is it a mirage when you get up to the kinds of cases that go to the United States Supreme Court. In the 1920s, and I don't remember the specific year, the dean at Yale, Robert Post, did an article about this just a few years ago, which was fascinating. It was about the passage of the statute that gave the U.S. Supreme Court control over its docket. And so what Post did was he started to trace the correspondence between Chief Justice Taft, Robert Taft, who had been president, was now Chief Justice, and Oliver Wendell Holmes, because Taft was getting very upset about the dissents on the court. But the point that Post was making was, on the old court, the 19th century court, most of the cases were very ordinary kinds of issues that didn't have the great political ramifications. But once you passed the certiorari statute, the court was getting the cases with substantial political ramifications, and that was becoming an ordinary part of its diet. So, however ambiguous law is in the lower courts, and sometimes it is there too, but that ambiguity gets magnified as you go up the judicial system, and particularly once you get to the Supreme Court, if you don't convince the court that there's an issue to be resolved, they won't give you cert. So that court depends on good judgment.
Would it be wrong to see the United States Supreme Court today as five Republicans and four Democrats?
Well, I think you'd have to engage in some fractions because
you guys teach law here, you know that.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, and I want to make sure that the distinction between law and politics becomes apparent.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by apparent, because there's an overlap. That's the point.
You think it's an overlap?
At the Supreme Court level, there is very clearly an overlap, because there are so many ways of looking at these cases. You're never divorced from your philosophical point of view. It's impossible. What I tried to argue in my book on the Rehnquist Court was the justices have no choice. They all do that. And it's not because some justices are good justices and some justices are bad justices. So I wasn't, for example, arguing that there's something wrong with Roberts because he exercises judgment as opposed to calling balls and strikes by some clear standard, by looking at the metrics. Because they can't help it. They all do it. What I'm trying to argue...
Wait, Stephen, for a second. If Hillary Clinton gets elected president or Bernie Sanders, and they appoint a majority of the court, so now it's 5-4 the other way or 6-3, you know, it's almost like a Rorschach test. You know what's going to happen, and you know that basically it's partisan in nature. So I don't think it is both. I think it's just a question of who appointed them, and they were very lucky that they had the brains to appoint a John Roberts when he was a kid, who's going to be on that court forever. So I would argue with you that you people in this law school are deceiving yourselves when you say that there are legal issues here.
There are legal issues. I read a 6-3 case just this morning. I forget which of the Roberts and Kennedy voted with the bloc of the liberals. Actually, it was 6-2.
I saw it. It was a question about kids in prison, right? Was that the one?
No. It was the one on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, okay. And Alito did not vote. So it was actually 6-2. It may have been 6-3 on the kids in prison case as well. I don't have as clearly fixed in my head what the numbers were, but you're right. I looked at that one too this morning. And, you know, there are legal issues where virtually everyone comes out in the same place, with the exception of Thomas and Scalia. They're different. But in a way, they're claiming to use a particular tool, but I think using it actually very poorly, because actually looking at the text does persuade most of us in most circumstances. But most of the time, the text can sustain a lot of different meanings. So there are legal issues. They're important, but most of the time at that level, they're not decisive. They set parameters. There are things that are off the scale. So
but Stephen, they use the you're right. I mean, there's a lot of legal material floating around, and they'll reach in wherever they have to in order to justify their actions. But it isn't as if, you know, they're really doing anything but being Republicans, or in some cases, Democrats.
Except that there are lots of different kinds of Republicans and lots of different kinds of Democrats. And
well, no, I'm talking about these guys.
No, I am too. Kennedy, for example, is obviously much more libertarian than many of his colleagues on the court.
Right.
And it's been obvious for a long time that he felt that. He also, if there are any of the conservatives that I would hope to reach with my argument, it would be Kennedy. Kennedy is clearly a Republican. He worked very hard for Reagan and many Republican causes. There's no question about that. But I was just talking with a student describing a case not long after Kennedy joined the court where he made an argument that showed the extent to which he did feel the pull of Democratic values. Now, obviously, in the campaign finance cases, he feels that what's really most important is the First Amendment value that he sees in a libertarian sort of way. But there are other cases where he's the one in that group of cases that's likely to break off. On the other hand, he's not so likely to break off in the economics cases. And there have been other battles between Thomas and Scalia and the other conservatives, sometimes even between Thomas and Scalia. It was Joan Crawford wrote a book some years ago where she described Thomas as being the sort of the Jiminy Cricket of the right wing on the court, not Scalia, and his pushing people sometimes in the conferences to come over to his way of thinking, which is fairly extreme even on this court. So you can say that within limits. On some of the hot button issues, it's pretty obvious what's going to happen. Maybe there's one vote or another that's going to shift a little bit. A lot of cases where Breyer votes with the conservatives. So I don't think of Breyer as a liberal. I know somebody who knows Ginsburg very well and has described her as a conservative to me. Now, the, quote, conservatives today won't think of her that way, and there are lots of cases where she carries the liberal flag very proudly. But there are cases that are very surprising where she doesn't. So I understand and I read the literature of the political scientists who argue that you can scale the justices on a left-right scale, but actually it's multiple scales on multiple issues.
And yet you've chosen to name your book Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Court, and the Breakdown of American Politics. Clearly, you're extraordinarily unhappy with the guy and with his court. And clearly, you make the point, chapter 9 is a wonderful chapter. If you read no other chapter, read chapter 9 in the book. But you lay out all the substance.
Lawyers should also read chapter 10.
Yeah, but you lay out all of the damage that the court has done. And yet you sit here, and I'm a little bit afraid of you, Stephen, because I think that...
I checked my gun.
I think that lawyers want to believe in law and in the concept of law. And I don't. I mean, I don't think that that's what this court is all about. And I think you make the case in your book. So I'm just wondering what this is all about. In the meantime, I just want to say something. We are in the Albany Law School in conversation with professor, legal scholar, author, and WAMC commentator Stephen Gottlieb. Stephen Gottlieb's latest book is Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Court, and the Breakdown of American Democracy. So let's talk about some substantive stuff.
So while you mentioned that you're at Albany Law School, what's in there is an Albany Law School mug for you.
I get a mug? That's just what I need, you know.
To go along with my WAMC mug.
Yeah, there it is. And thank you. I don't want to seem unappreciative. I wanted to get some substantive areas covered here, which you do very well in the book. Let me start with criminal justice.
Oh, you know, as was true on the Rehnquist Court, also on the Roberts Court, there are decisions that just turn my stomach.
But there are cases in which the people that were being sued, civil litigation, were district attorneys. But what they were being sued for was intentionally and deliberately withholding evidence that would have made it clear that people were spending a large part of their lives in prison despite being innocent. And after people got out, after periods like 25 years, they're saying, you're liable to me because you broke the law. It's not you made a judgment. You have a responsibility that has been defined for decades by the Supreme Court to turn over evidence that would be exculpatory evidence that would help the defense. These are cases which ultimately, because of new technology, it was possible to prove conclusively that these individuals had not committed the crime of which they were convicted. But the prosecutors prevented the release of that evidence. In one of the cases, they refused to put together a system for keeping track of the promises that were made to witnesses, so that when someone got in touch with the prosecutor handling a particular case, he would not know what had been done. One of those cases, a grand jury in Los Angeles County had, this was about 1990, and it was covered the period in which one of the cases had developed, did an expose of the way that people who were in the jails picked up for some other crime were being bribed, and that's really the right word, bribed, to turn in evidence against somebody that the police or the DA wanted.
Jailhouse snitches.
Jailhouse snitches. And they were being offered deals such that the snitches knew how to get their way out of jail.
In fact, the point you make brilliantly in the book is that several of these guys who turned on one defendant or another had multiple snitching on different people in order to mitigate their sentences.
That's right. And yet the court said, there is no liability on the part of a prosecutor, no matter basically what they have done. And what does innocence count to these guys? By the way, I was sitting in the courtroom when one of those cases was argued, and behind me was the lawyer who was sort of scouting out the situation for his own argument, saying that he was very stressed about making that argument to the court because the situation in that city was so egregious. But he won. But there's yet another case in which the court decided, no, a defendant does not have a right to DNA evidence. Now, many of the states are providing it, But in the federal system, defendant does not have that right. And
Wait. How can these guys look at themselves in the mirror?
Did you know my former colleague, John Sands?
No.
Because he asked Justice Rehnquist almost exactly that question when Rehnquist spoke here in 1980. And Rehnquist basically said, well, I didn't do it. The law did it.
My point exactly.
Yes. But in that same case, the court continued to point out that it has not yet been willing to decide that actual innocence is a ground for getting out of prison. That goes back to the case in the Rehnquist court that turned my stomach, because that was a case where the court said that even though there was very substantial evidence, Blackmun in dissent wrote, if the evidence presented to the court suggests that it is probably true that they're innocent, we should have a court look at the evidence. And Rehnquist said, no, not even in that circumstance. That's the Herrera case that I have spoken about with great angst for, it's now 20-odd years. That was a 1993 decision. These cases pick up from the Rehnquist court from that case and continue to say that that possibility that somebody might have a ground for saying, well, I'm innocent, therefore I should be free, that issue the court has not been willing to decide. Now, many of the states, again, will give someone a remedy. You're behind bars and you can show evidence that that's a miscarriage of justice. Here's the key, but not the federal Supreme Court. In my view, aside from the impact on democracy and when the guarantees that you will not be kept in prison simply because the prosecutor wants you to be there, when those guarantees dissipate, the possibility for controlling the population in very serious ways are there. And we've been talking in the Black Lives Matter movement and the incarceration of largely African men, but not exclusively, over the last several decades has become huge and has huge political ramifications. A lot of that is for stuff that is clearly a sort of a prosecutor fingers that guy and thinks, well, he doesn't count. That's a no good, let's get him off the street. Whereas anyone else in the same situation wouldn't spend a day in prison.
So the court, 5-4 often, says, okay, we want to keep these people in prison, this is what we do. From a philosophical point of view, from a power point of view, who are they representing? In other words, obviously it's not just five guys looking at law briefs. It's people who are saying, we were put here for a reason, isn't it?
Yes, and that, of course, goes back to the election of 1968, when Nixon promised to do that and to start the court on its conservative slide. That, by the way, was just 3 years after I got my law degree, so you could describe my legal practice as a long conservative slide. But who are they representing? Well, I mean,
they're representing the same guys the Ayatollah is representing in Iran, right? They maybe a minority who want to keep everybody in line and are willing to use whatever resources they have to do that?
Well, I'm sure that there's more than one group that they're representing, and you would be much more competent to speak about the politics than I am. I mean, I've looked at the conservative movement's financial and legal reins and how they're moving the court, but I haven't been trying to sort of unravel all the politics.
But I used the word Rorschach test before, but I'll give you another Rorschachian. My mother was an expert on the Rorschach test, so she would hold up something and she said,
thank God my mother didn't give me a Rorschach test. I would have failed them all.
She said, what do you think this is? I'd say, it's a bat. And she'd say, don't you think it might be a butterfly? So,
did you know that in Chautauqua Institution in New York, bats are called Chautauqua butterflies?
Isn't that?
And we have the T-shirts to prove it.
That is fascinating.
Yes.
No. Okay. So I need, but okay. So we took one Rorschach, which is criminal justice. Let's take another. And I'm telling you, this group represents You say it's many different people, but it's a coalition. Let's talk about labor unions.
Oh.
What we're talking about is a conservative movement, and here there is a fairly obvious, somewhat different group behind this. But this is an effort to remove the power from labor unions. So you can say, for example, that when they, in Citizens United, allowed the corporations to put treasury money into politics, that they allowed the labor unions to put it, except that all of their other decisions are making sure that labor unions have less and less money to put into the political scene. And the case that's in front of the court now is in a line of cases where they have less and less finances even to do the negotiations that they're hired by the workers to do. And so the court can't remove the certification of the union as bargaining unit, but it's doing its best to remove its funds. And that is part of the process of pushing the politics. You take the labor unions out of the politics, you leave the African Americans and minorities in prison, and you prevent minorities of all kinds who might vote Democratic from getting to the polls, and you have the court controlling who wins elections in America. And of course, then that sets up the further issue that then you really have to circle the wagons because you have this horde of people pushing back and you have a real possibility for losing even the semblance of self-government as this gets polarized.
The Gore election, right? Gore and Bush.
Well, certainly. I mean, that was, of course, not the Roberts Court.
No.
Although several of the justices were on that, including several of the justices in the majority. Three of the justices were in the majority, present justices were in the majority on the Rehnquist Court in that decision. I don't see any explanation for what the court did. Every explanation that the court came up with in Bush versus Gore was directly contrary to what the court had been saying about equal protection, and it was basically out of whole cloth.
So you don't see any rationale for what they did? I think most of us in this room are pretty clear about their rationale for what they did.
Oh, what I'm saying is when you get rid of the so-called legal explanations, you and I end up with the same rationale, which was they picked the president. And they couldn't imagine America happening to have been governed by Al Gore, who I think would have, well, it's not relevant in this discussion what I think about Al Gore, but certainly I think he was a very responsible, respectable individual who had American interests at heart, whether you agree or disagree with him. But they clearly picked George Bush in that campaign. And indeed, there were reasons why some of them should have recused themselves because of personal ties to the Bush campaign. And I think it really rather outrageous that they did not.
How important is it when the court gives itself a black eye? That was a black eye for the court. Yes?
Yes.
And is there permanent damage?
You know, the permanent damage depends on our being able to keep the heat on. And, of course, what happened after Bush versus Gore was Iraq, was 9/11, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And in a funny sort of way, that put a lot of heat on the Bush administration and on the Republicans, but it sort of took the issue away from the court. One of the things that, frankly, I'm concerned about, and I don't see her at the moment in the audience, but Alice Green and I have talked about, she was here earlier, is keeping the heat on now that has been raised by the Black Lives Matter people, for example. You have to keep it up. As a commentator on the station, I often laugh at myself because I can make a great argument and I get complimented by some people and vilified by others, but that argument just sort of fades unless somehow you can keep it up. And there's where, although I'm sort of uncomfortable with the what gets called PAC journalism,
where everybody focuses on the same issue. But it seems that if you're part of PAC journalism, you're part of a movement that's going to make a difference. So how significant is it? One case and one book aren't going to change America. It's going to take a lot of keeping it up and keeping the pressure up if we're going to be able to do it. Maybe we can change a few votes, and maybe this election will be that close.
Yes. In fact, I wanted to go there. I can make an argument to you that Donald Trump is going to be the next president of the United States. I can see how it could happen.
Let's Trump that.
What happens to the Supreme Court if Trump becomes the president?
I don't know if anybody knows. I mean, Bush had made clear who he wanted as justices. He said, I want somebody like Scalia. I don't know that Trump has done that.
Mm-mm.
So I think that's a really wild card. Of course, my understanding is that Trump has bankrupted everything he's touched. Is that too strong?
That's too strong.
Okay. So I don't know. I mean, that's not something that I have any expertise at, but I haven't heard.
I think for those of us who are looking at this as what potential damage might come out of an election, and I certainly have my views on that, if Cruz gets elected, we're pretty sure of what would happen. He would have an even more conservative court than we have now. But Trump, the deal maker, you never know.
That's right.
What might be good for him. So when you wrote this book, was there steam coming out of your ears?
Oh, yes. About many of the cases that we've talked about and some that we haven't. And it was very clear to me that I wanted to write the book in strong language. I didn't want anybody to miss my point about the Roberts Court. So,
what is a book like this? What difference does it make that you wrote it and you were angry?
What difference does it make?
In other words, are people lining up at their bookstores to buy the book?
Well, I know some bookstore owners that hope so, and maybe an author that might hope so, but I'm trying to be realistic, of course.
So when you write a book like this, what's the purpose of it?
Well, the purpose is to make the point that we've been making today. To a certain extent, Alan, a book is a platform. It gives the author of the book the opportunity to get out a point, an understanding that the author feels is important for people to have. When I did my last book, I was on a lot of radio and television. I even talked to a station in Australia. And it gave me an opportunity to explain some of the things that I think were important to understand about the Rehnquist Court. And I'm hoping that this book will give me a similar opportunity, as it is doing in this conversation that we're having, to explain some things about the Roberts Court. And as I say, even though, you know, I don't try to hide my politics, but this is really an effort to go deeper than that and get to fundamental American values and talk about the science that has explored where those values mean we need to go.
Does the media, as a grouping, does the media cover the Supreme Court correctly? Or do they basically, you know, you have Linda Greenhouse, you might have a couple of other people, but is the court explained to the American people?
Linda Greenhouse, by the way, spoke here some years ago.
Sure.
And I had the privilege of meeting and talking with her then and on subsequent occasions. And I think Linda Greenhouse is wonderful. And I think her successor, Adam Liptak, is wonderful. By the way, Adam Liptak's position, his former position, is now occupied by one of our graduates, David McCraw, as vice president of the New York Times. I think they're excellent, and there are other excellent Supreme Court reporters. And I think, depending upon, you know, the kind of piece that they're writing, they're certainly capable of explaining the left-right politics. I'm trying to add something to that. I'm trying to add, and I have been in touch with Linda Greenhouse. I sent her a copy of the book, and she's responded to me. I'm trying to add to their understanding of the implications of what the court is doing.
So if you stood out on Holland Avenue or whatever and asked the first 100 people who passed, who's on the Supreme Court of the United States, what do you think you'd get?
Well, of course, this is the corner of a law school. And so depending upon the time of day, I would get a very knowledgeable audience at certain times of day who would be able to name all nine justices. I have no doubt about
that. Let me respond, no, you wouldn't. Not only that, I've had my students stand out in front of the legislative office building and ask who the lieutenant governor was. And zero is what you get. So that this business of
you mean it's not still Patterson?
So this business of, you know, educating people as to this, I would posit, secretive institution is extremely important for what we're about.
Yes, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Alan. And your station is very much a part of
it. Ain't mine.
That story out.
It's ours.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I say that with pride.
So the way that we frame all of this is we have a Congress, we have a House of Representatives, we have a Senate, we have a President, and we have a Supreme Court. Of that group, ultimately, is the Supreme Court the most important of all of those American institutions?
You could say that at a given moment, but Congress and the President choose the justices, and they have other levers of power. I don't mean to say that the court's decisions are the only things that are important, although the court has nullified what Congress and the President agreed to with respect to campaign finance, for example. So the court has to have a partner. It doesn't act by itself.
Well,
it
indeed.
Needs partners. And those partners are either state governments or they are other branches of the federal government. But the court is not, in that sense, independent. So it needs a partner when it's saying yes. It can act on its own when it's saying no. Now, a philosopher will tell you that you can say no so many times that you have defined the yes, but actually the justices can't stay on the court long enough to do that job. So there really is a very different situation when there's something afoot that the court doesn't like from when there's something that the court wants, but nobody's doing it.
We're out of time. Thanks for joining us. We've been live at the Albany Law School in conversation with professor, legal scholar, author, and WAMC commentator Stephen Gottlieb. Stephen's latest book is Unfit for Democracy, The Roberts Cause and the Breakdown of American Democracy. I can recommend it to all of you. Stephen Gottlieb, thanks so much for joining us today.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.